From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Gun control, the fiscal cliff, and disarray in Washington. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The National Rifle Association today broke the silence it's maintained since last week's elementary school massacre in Connecticut. The NRA's top spokesman said the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, demanding that Congress pay for armed guards in every schoolyard. We'll hear how that could affect the renewed debate about gun control. Meantime, the failure of House Speaker Boehner's Plan B has increased doubts that the fiscal cliff can be avoided before the end of the year. Can the president and fellow Democrats cobble together some kind of a fix that a few House Republicans might support? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Congress has adjourned for Christmas after Speaker John Boehner failed to get all his fellow Republicans to support his Plan B. Later on, we'll look at the possible options left for the president and Democrats who only control the Senate. First, this news update. The NRA's Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre said today that the lives of 20 Connecticut first graders might have been saved last week if school officials had guns. He called for every school to be protected by armed guards.
It's now time for us to assume responsibility for our schools. The only way to stop a monster from killing our kids is to be personally involved and invested in a plan of absolute protection. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
John Sullivan is political reporter for The Washington Post. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
The NRA is a very powerful voice in Washington. We'll hear more about what Mr. LaPierre had to say as our program goes forward. But how do you think this is going to change the debate?
Well, what this does is it sets up two really starkly different views. What we've heard over the last week or so since this tragic shooting in Connecticut is a lot from gun control advocates pressing for stepped up efforts to make it, to outlaw assault weapons and things like that. And what we got today was a very, very different perspective, which is to say, you know, the way that we should address this is by arming more people and having armed guards in schools. So it sets up a really stark debate where, you know, it's pretty black and white, and the two sides couldn't be more different, really.
It was not an entirely quiet affair today. LaPierre appeared on a podium with a big black screen behind him. Somehow, however, there were protesters in the audience, and he was twice interrupted by them. They were carrying signs saying, NRA killing our kids.
NRA, stop killing our children. It's the NRA and the assault weapons that are killing our children, not armed teachers. We've got to end the arming. We've got to end the violence. We've got to stop the killing.
So, Sean Sullivan, we hear those two voices expressed, obviously, in very different ways, not any kind of a solemn debate. And I take it LaPierre didn't take any questions.
No, he didn't take any questions at all. In fact, he read a statement and left. And as you mentioned, this was not, you know, necessarily the most cordial affair. He had two interruptions from protesters. And if you listen to LaPierre's words, he sort of took a pretty confrontational tone at times, reprimanding the media for the way that they cover or perhaps don't cover things like violent video games and violent films and the way that those things contribute to our culture and where that fits into this debate. So he didn't take any questions. He was interrupted twice. And like I said, you know, a fairly confrontational posture at times, which is pretty interesting.
Have others suggested that the federal government should pay to provide armed guards in every school in America? And do we know what that might cost?
We don't know immediately. There are other voices who have said this, but you know what's important about today is, you know, this is the prominent leader of the most prominent gun rights group in the country, and so when he says it, you know, it's different than you know, local officials who are advocating for this or lesser known officials, and this will immediately thrust this idea onto the national radar and force lawmakers and people on both sides of the debate to confront something which I think is, you know, not something that most people are familiar with as an idea, just because it's not talked about on the national stage regularly.
On the other hand, of course, there are many schools, particularly high schools around the country, where there are armed guards on the campus and armed police forces all the time. Also present today was Asa Hutchinson. He's a former congressman, former head of the Drug Enforcement Administration, who's going to head up a project for the NRA. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so what he's going to do is head up a project that will work with any schools that are interested in working with the NRA on this, and it'll involve, in his words, volunteers, perhaps others in the local community who want to work to make schools safer. Hutchinson was a former congressman and headed up the DEA under President George W. Bush, and so, you know, I think when you look at this today, this is the NRA's way of saying, here's a concrete piece of action that we are taking to address this crisis. Here's an initiative that we're unveiling. Here's our answer in the immediate term to this crisis and how to avoid it in the future.
And in the meantime, the president is once again asking for public support to get more controls on guns.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And he was out with a web video early this morning, you know, saying that, you know, he reiterated sort of where he stands on this issue. And he came out earlier this week and said, yes, he is in favor of taking action in Congress to pass a federal ban on assault weapons, and that's something that Senator Feinstein has said she's going to introduce at the beginning of the next Congress. So the president wants the public on his side. The public actually wants the president on their side. On White House petition website, hundreds of thousands of people have been chiming in and encouraging the president to take action on this issue, and he's responding.
Okay. Again, Sean Sullivan is political reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you very much for telling us about this news conference today by Wayne LaPierre of the National Rifle Association. In a moment, we're going to hear much more about it. And later on our program, we'll be talking about the fiscal cliff and what might happen now that Plan B has failed to get the support of all the Republicans in the House. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. In his lengthy statement today, the NRA's Wayne LaPierre was defensive about attacks on his organization and what he characterized as the media's predisposition to be against guns.
A gun in the hands of a Secret Service agent protecting our president isn't a bad word. A gun in the hands of a soldier protecting the United States of America isn't a bad word. And when you hear your glass breaking at 3 a.m. and you call 911, you won't be able to pray hard enough for a gun in the hands of a good guy to get there fast enough to protect you.
Tom Diaz is author of two books, The Business of Guns in America and The Last Gun, How the Gun Industry is Killing Americans and What We Can Do to Stop It. Tom Diaz, good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much, Warren. It's a pleasure to be here.
How do you respond to what Wayne LaPierre said today, particularly the notion that the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is with a good guy with a gun?
Well, you're calling, I think, from the home of Hollywood, and you probably know about the series Looney Tunes. And really, there's nothing remarkable about Wayne LaPierre, what he said today, except that it sort of reiterated the standard NRA line, which is guns make us safer. Only good guys use guns. And as he said, you need a gun to stop a bad guy. There are three or four things I could say that are just factually wrong in what Wayne LaPierre said. First, he used, as the NRA often uses, and as Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, incorrectly used, in his opinion, striking down the D.C. gun law. It's this bugaboo of burglary. You hear a glass breaking and somebody's breaking into your home. This is actually an extremely rare phenomenon in the United States that a residence is occupied when a person burglars it. And even when it is, it's most often someone that you know. What that raises at a public policy level is, what is better, to have a gun in your home or to secure your home from the very rare chance that you will be burglarized? The NRA lives in sort of a fantasy world, and they didn't hardly ever let facts get in the way of their kind of ideology. Now, with respect to the question of this armed guard business, I think what LaPierre conveniently ignored is in one of the most, I guess one of the first most horrendous school shootings, that's the one at Columbine High School, there actually was an armed guard. Actually, I think there were two armed guards at that school. And one of them actually did engage one of the shooters, Klebold. And there was a shootout between them, and it didn't stop him at all. Klebold just ran into the building and continued. So that's one point. We've tried this armed guard thing, and it really doesn't work. And the question you want to ask yourself is, in the case of Sandy Hook, the shooter was armed with a semi-automatic assault rifle. So now, should the school guards have semi-automatic assault rifles with 20, 40 rounds of ammunition flying out of there around your school children? That's number one. Number two, it's a known phenomenon in the world of terrorism, for example. It's called perimeter expansion. So when we started checking people before they got on airplanes, the people who wanted to harm airplanes just expanded the perimeter, putting bombs in the luggage. When we started checking the luggage, then they began to hijack airplanes. The point is that someone who wants to do this kind of evil is going to expand beyond whatever kind of armed security you put. Do you want to put armed guards on school buses? Now we're talking about big money. We not only have guards in schools, but in large school districts, 10, 15, 20 buses, now you have to have armed guards for there. Who's going to pay for it? And finally, this attack on video games and movies, which are global. And yet, we don't see globally these kinds of horrific mass shootings that we see in the United States. And that may be something you'll want to talk about later, the effects of video games and violence in films. If that really was the source of these shootings, why don't we see that in Great Britain? Why don't we see it in Canada? Why don't we see it in Australia or France? And the simple answer is that whatever tendencies may be aggravated by the media or what have you, there's not that easy availability of killing machines that there is in the United States. So Wayne LaPierre, like I said, is kind of in Looney Tunesville.
Okay.
But that raises another question, it's never really been about the NRA. We need to stop blaming the NRA as if it has some kind of dark, evil power. Lord Voldemort, he who shall not be spoken of, controls us. It's really the problem of people who want to stop gun violence. They need to get more organized, just like the NRA has been, more aggressive, and most importantly of all, establish grassroots power so that they can do what the NRA does.
Okay.
Deliver messages, deliver votes.
Tom Diaz again, Making a Killing, The Business of Guns in America, and The Last Gun, How the Gun Industry is Killing Americans and What We Can Do to Stop It. Earlier this morning, before Mr. LaPierre spoke, President Obama released a videotape urging public support for renewing the assault weapons ban and other new regulations as well.
In the days since the heartbreaking tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, hundreds of thousands of you from all 50 states have signed petitions asking us to take serious steps to address the epidemic of gun violence in this country. So I just wanted to take a minute today to respond and let you know we hear you.
Craig Whitney is a former reporter for the New York Times. He's now author of Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Are we in the debate that we're having with the National Rifle Association and such gun opponents as Tom Diaz losing track of something? Is that what your title suggests?
Well, I think that the Second Amendment recognizes an individual right to have and use firearms, for good or for worse. That's what the Second Amendment did. And the question today and for in recent years has always been, how do you reconcile that with the right of the public to live in safety? I don't think Wayne LaPierre's suggestion is a completely bad idea, but I would suggest, why don't we take him up on it and say, okay, we're going to finance it by imposing a $100 per assault rifle tax, or more than $100, $1,000, on anybody who buys one. That's how we'll finance armed guards in schools. His suggestion, of course, wasn't meant to be serious. What are we going to do, have armed guards in every mall, movie theater, et cetera, et cetera. But an assault weapons ban like the one that was in power for 10 years from 94 to 04 is not going to solve this problem, and just renewing it the way it was won't either, because it had too many loopholes and grandfathered clauses.
Can't you write a law that doesn't have those?
Well, I think they ought to try, but try to define what an assault weapon is, and then try to distinguish that from the many similar or even higher powered hunting rifles that people have. It's not that easy. I think it would be simpler to outlaw extended magazines and confiscate or urge people to turn in the ones they have. That might do more to stop the kind of violence we saw in Newtown than renewing an assault weapons ban the way it was, or even modified.
You said that the idea of having armed guards in schools isn't a completely bad idea. What do you say to what we just heard from Tom Diaz, that in the case of Columbine, there were two armed guards, one of whom engaged with a shooter. That didn't stop them. People who really want to create this kind of atrocity will find other ways to do it.
I think there's no one solution to this problem that we're ever going to find. Stricter gun laws aren't going to solve it by themselves. Having armed guards in every school wouldn't eliminate the possibility that this could happen. But as the reporter from the Washington Post said, about a third of all schools now do have armed guards. And, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that, but it alone is not going to prevent this kind of thing from happening.
Back to Tom Diaz, one of the things that Mr. LaPierre said today is that when you create a gun-free zone around a school, you let everybody know who wants to create this kind of mayhem that they can do it there safely and effectively because nobody's there with a gun to stop them. How do you respond to that and the fact that there are armed guards already in so many schools? Should we take them away?
But we shouldn't lose the focus on what we're talking about here. There's a reason why in the United States, in contrast with every other industrialized nation, the children are killed are the victim of homicide at a rate 17 times higher than any other. Their suicide rate is 10 times higher than any other industrialized nation. It's because of the guns, and that's what we have to keep our focus on. Now, the guards that already exist in schools, for the most part, perform the same kind of function that going through the luggage line at the airport does. They're there to man magnetometers, and they're there to sort of discourage violence, and they're there to stop violence in the hallways. What we do know is that in the most important occasion in which the armed guards actually engage the shooter, it doesn't work. I do want to respond to the question about defining an assault weapon and the 1994 law. It's absolutely correct that the 1994 assault weapons ban was virtually useless. If anything, it spawned Bushmaster firearms because of two things. One,
Bushmaster, of course, the kind of firearm that was used last week. Go ahead.
Right, it's an AR-15 clone. And the 1994 law did two things, which I think we've learned, and I hope any legislation that Senator Feinstein or the president advocates will go much beyond that. One, that law, the 94 law, did something called grandfathering. It grandfathered every legally owned assault weapon in the United States. And legally owned meant it could be in the inventory of a manufacturer, it could be in the inventory of an importer on its way over. So there were millions of guns that were just, it was as if the law never passed. So that's number one. If we grandfather the existing assault weapons, we might as well all fold up our tents and go home because there's so many of them. Number two, the definition of an assault weapon was pinned on what I call bells and whistles, almost entirely irrelevant cosmetic features like bayonet mounts, extendable stocks, flash suppressors, things that do not function as a matter of design in an assault weapon. Now we get to the question, which is appropriately raised, okay, how are you going to define an assault weapon and how do you distinguish it from, for example, a hunting rifle? That's really not as complicated or as difficult as people make it out to be, and certainly not the obscurities in the National Rifle Association and the gun industry, because there's a long, well-documented design history of assault rifles that goes back to 1944, when the Germans invented the first assault rifle called an STG-44 for Sturmgewehr, which meant storm rifle or assault rifle. Then you had the Chinese AK-47. Then you had the United States M16, which the prototype model was actually called the AR-15. And now you have others. The key determinant, the main thing that defines these rifles, in addition to a couple other features, is the ability to accept and use a high-capacity magazine, meaning certainly more than 10 rounds, but 20, 40, I mean, there are magazines, drum magazines, that even go up to 110 rounds. California, incidentally, very successfully, after many tries, has a really good semi-automatic assault weapon ban, and it keys off of that question of magazine capacity. We should also ban the magazines, and when I say ban, I don't mean grandfathering. I mean get rid of them.
Craig Whitney, quickly, back to you. What about the point that in other countries they have the same exposure to a violent film and all that sort of thing as we do here, and yet they don't have anything like the kind of gun violence that we do? Isn't that a function of the number of guns we have? Isn't the obvious way to eliminate it to get rid of the guns, or at least not to allow them to circulate the way they have now?
Well, good luck with that. We have 300 million guns in this country, and they don't have as many guns in any other European or developed country that I know of. And yes, that is the reason why the rates of violent crimes with guns are higher here than they are there. But you're not going to get rid of the 300 million guns. I think the key to the Newtown problem and to a lot of the mass shootings that we've seen is just what the previous speaker just said. Concentrate on the extended magazines. That's the design feature of the so-called assault rifles that has proved fatal in so many of these instances, and that's what you've got to try to get at. And there's no infringement of the right to have and use firearms if you limit the capacity of the gun to not hold as many bullets as a soldier firing a fully automatic assault rifle would use.
Very, very quickly, we need to go to a break, but aren't they easy to make on your own?
What, the magazine?
The extended magazine, yeah.
Well, most people can't, no.
Okay.
I would say, you know, not most people.
Okay. Craig Whitney again, Living with Guns, a Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment. Tom Diaz, Making a Killing, the Business of Guns in America, and The Last Gun, How the Gun Industry is Killing Americans and What We Can Do to Stop It. We're going to continue this conversation after we take a brief break on Reporter's Notebook later on. What's next for the fiscal cliff? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
We're not only back with To the Point. In today's statement, NRA leader Wayne LaPierre described what he called a dirty little truth about the media.
There exists in this country, sadly, a callous, corrupt, and corrupting shadow industry that sells and stows violence against its own people. Through vicious, violent video games with names like Bulletstorm, Grand Theft Auto, Mortal Kombat, and Splatterhouse.
Brooks Barnes is a media reporter for the New York Times. Brooks Barnes, good to have you on our program.
Hi, how are you?
Good. This also, of course, extends, and Mr. LaPierre mentioned this as well, to Hollywood films. How does Hollywood respond to this? And he went on to say that the people in Hollywood, while on the one hand they are liberal and attack the idea of guns, on the other hand, profit from spreading the idea that there's a kind of glorification going on.
Right. Well, there's no doubt about it. There are a lot of people who are feeling like hypocrites this week, distributing movies, making movies that have a lot of violence, and yet at the same point having that political view. The point that Hollywood says pushes back on is that this is something that we want to leave in the hands of the audience, and if the audience wasn't consuming this in huge quantities, then we would, we're exceptionally attuned to that. We would be putting out more of something else. You can poke all sorts of holes in that, but that's the pushback you hear.
What are the holes you could push in it?
Well, that people buy what they have the option to buy is one. It's a movie like The Dark Knight Rises comes out, and it's virtually in every movie theater. You don't have a lot of choice as to what to go to that weekend if you want to go to the movies.
What about the game makers and the where you actually do it yourself rather than watching somebody else do it?
That's something that doesn't get as much attention as it should. It seems to me that the knee jerk is also often to go straight for what's on screens, movies, and television that way. But the studios will point out that we're presenting a passive experience. You're sitting there and watching something especially in a movie theater that you're trained to understand is a fantasy world. And in the when you're talking about a video game, it's an interactive experience. You're the one controlling how often that gun is shot. And that's another option that's another argument that they use in terms of, it's not us, it's them.
Let's hear one more comment from Wayne LaPierre that's relevant, I think, to all of our guests, including one we haven't heard from as yet. Listen, here it is.
Politicians passed laws for gun-free school zones. They issue press releases bragging about them. They post signs advertising them. And in doing so, they tell every insane killer in America that schools are the safest place to inflict maximum mayhem with minimum risk.
So, once again, Mr. LaPierre is blaming the culture in its many forms and also the failure to arm people in the appropriate places. And he said again, we heard him mention insane killers there, that there are people, he raised the question of whether there aren't people already getting ready to attack other schools because they feel, given the publicity that's been given to this incident, that they'll be able to get away with that kind of mayhem. Adam Lankford is assistant professor of criminal justice at the University of Alabama. He's author of a forthcoming book, The Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers and Rampage Shooters and Other Self-Destructive Killers. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How do you respond to that? Are the man who committed the atrocity in Connecticut and others that have done so earlier this year and in other instances, are they in fact driven by the culture? And do they look around for safe places as they plot their insane crimes?
Well, that's a good question. One of the things I do in my research is I parallel rampage shooters on the one hand with suicide terrorists on the other hand. And it's very clear when you do this kind of comparative analysis that suicide terrorists in Palestine, for instance, they are driven by this idea that they are worshipped in that society. So at most recent count, 68% of average people in Palestine believe that suicide bombings were justified. So when you talk about the problems of the culture, certainly we're not in a society that's anything like Palestine where people are worshiping and glorifying attackers like Adam Lanza.
Why, then, do rampage shooters do what they do?
Well, there's a variety of reasons. They certainly have mental illness, suicidal tendencies. They feel like they're victims. They're often looking for attention. One of the things I would emphasize in terms of this conversation is that rampage shooters are usually suicidal, and they're often looking to die either by shooting themselves in the head or by provoking a firefight, suicide by cop. So if you put armed guards at schools, that's not a barrier for people who want to die. Now, it may reduce the total carnage, but people who want to die and are itching for that kind of firefight, they're not going to be deterred by armed guards.
So does that suggest that they might even be attracted by armed guards? We hear sometimes about, as you pointed out, the suicide by cop.
Yes. Well, sometimes you do see these kind of mass shooters specifically go to places where they know they're going to see a lot of armed guards. For instance, Nadal Hassan attacked at a military base with military police armed there, specifically because he knew that would end in his death. As it turned out, he got shot in the spine and was only paralyzed, but he certainly wanted and intended to die.
So back to Craig Whitney, again, Living with Guns, a liberal's case for the Second Amendment. We do have something like a third of the schools in the country with armed guards. You indicated you didn't think that was completely a bad idea. What about the prospect that it might be making things worse rather than better?
Well, who knows? I think that the issue of mental illness and how we detect and treat it and help people who have it in this country is worth a close look in the long term. We dismantled our mental health care system, which was not very good, when we closed mental hospitals and turned patients basically loose, but we didn't replace it with anything. And we pay the price in episodes like this one.
Adam Langford, back to you. It's my understanding, we've heard on this program this week, that most mentally ill people don't commit violent crimes. I'd be just interested in your take on that, what LaPierre said today, that we haven't managed to keep a national registry of mentally ill people. Would that tend to lead to scapegoating?
That's a rough sell. In other words, if you stigmatize mentally ill people and make them feel worse about themselves, you're likely to increase their sense of victimization and persecution and increase their desire for revenge against society. The other thing I would say, looking at what Mr. LaPierre said, he said the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, and there's some truth to that. But he's obscuring the fact that it's possible to keep a bad guy or a sick guy from getting that gun. So once you get to the point where you've got the mentally ill person who's suicidal and is opening fire, at that point someone needs to put that person down. But we want to stop things before it ever gets to that point.
Of course, Craig Whitney, then we go back to the point of the number of guns that are circulating in the United States, 300 million or so.
Right. Well, they're already out there, but he's absolutely right. We have a system that's designed to keep mentally ill people, criminals, drug addicts, and so on, from being able to buy a gun from a federally licensed dealer. But we let 40% of all gun sales, private sales anywhere, at gun shows or anywhere else, go without that background check, and that's designed to try to keep guns out of the hands of these people who shouldn't have them, which would do more to reduce gun violence than anything else I can think of.
Brooke Barnes, back to you, our media reporter for the New York Times. What sorts of movies are on the verge of being released or have already been released very recently? I know some have been withheld, at least very briefly.
Well, the one that's been impacted the most is a picture from Paramount called Jack Reacher that Tom Cruise stars in. It opens with a sniper shooting five people, and that's opening momentarily. And so that caused the studio to cancel the premiere. They didn't want people, stars, going down red carpets, both in terms of what that might look like and also what the stars might have be asked to discuss. And that meant that they also had to change their marketing And but then what you've got are studios and television networks that go through and look at marketing materials for, you know, what they've got on their deck for the next year, because they start marketing these movies that are released globally months and months in advance. And so you've got studios like Fox looking at its new Die Hard movie in February. Do we have a problem with that? You've got Lionsgate, which is releasing a movie, Texas Chainsaw 3D. That one they looked at, and they're like, well, we've already changed the name after the Aurora shootings from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. We dropped the massacre, so I think we're okay. So that's the sort of thing that you're seeing going on inside the studios right now.
Let me go back to Tom Diaz, our first guest, author of Making a Killing, The Business of Guns in America, and The Last Gun, How the Gun Industry is Killing Americans and What We Can Do to Stop It. Tell us a bit about how the NRA serves as a marketer of guns, and would you say that Mr. LaPierre had to say today was, in fact, designed to market guns?
Well, I do. The NRA acts as I call it sort of a laundry machine for the most extreme ideas that the gun industry itself could not advocate blankly. And, for example, there is a certain insurrectionist thread in American culture that the gun industry wouldn't feel comfortable saying, you know, you need our guns to resist a tyrannical government, because that implicates a lot. We saw one of the investors in the gun industry, just Cerberus Group, Cerberus just tried to drop out of its investments in Freedom Group, because that kind of message is just trouble for business. So the National Rifle Association, through its publications and the kind of fierce talk that we heard from Wayne LaPierre, and incidentally, Wayne LaPierre just basically gave the same speech that he gave at the last National Rifle Association convention. I mean, this is the kind of rhetoric that he and his publications continually engage in. The same thing with this need to defend yourself. Everybody has to have a gun, the good guys against the bad guys. What we're missing, I think, in this conversation, and we typically do when we're talking about in the wake of one of these big mass shootings, is that if every mass shooting in the United States stopped tomorrow, if there were no more mass shootings ever, we would still have an enormous toll of gun death and injury in the United States. Almost 30,000 people die every year. Let me just make a point by way of comparison. Every year in the United States, more Americans die from gun injury than have ever died in any terrorism, I'm sorry, not any, in all terrorism events since those events have been recorded, which goes back into the 1960s. Yes, more Americans die every single year than have ever been killed by terrorism. Not only that, more Americans die by gunshot than people of any nationality anywhere in the world are killed every year by terrorism. We lose sight of that perspective. Now, there's one other thing. We talk about mentally ill people, not mentally ill people. The everyday quotidian violence that goes on in this country is often committed by people who I defy anybody to come up with a test that will say, here's a husband who's going to come home because he's depressed, he's angry, his wife wants to leave, or he's found out she's having an affair, because it's usually men who do this, and kill their family, their wife, and sometimes their children, and themselves. These are law-abiding people, and quite typically, the guns that are used are, quote, legal guns. It's the access to the guns. Now, about half of the people that I talked about who die every year in the United States are suicides, and that's another question. It's the availability of the gun. It's the most effective means of suicide. The NRA and the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which incidentally is headquartered in Newtown, Connecticut, don't like to talk about that aspect of violence. Their view is righteous people have these guns and protect themselves and us. My view is just ordinary people with all of the defects we have, with all of the occasional mental illness, with anger, have access to these guns, and they're used in inappropriate circumstances hundreds of times a week. And we don't see that reported. If I were going to fault the news media, it wouldn't be because they're anti-gun. I would fault the news media for failing to just report on the everyday stream of violence that goes on all over America. And in the book that I've got coming out, The Last Gun, I document just in a typical week how many gun incidents are reported in the news media as compared to how many we know from years of tabulating data actually went on. And the difference is orders of magnitude.
Adam Lankford at the University of Alabama, quickly, as you were studying what really drives not just suicide bombers, but rampage shooters as well, and other people you refer to as self-destructive killers, did you find anybody who said that there was a way to identify in advance somebody who might commit the kind of crimes that we're talking about?
Actually, yes, there is some very exciting research when it comes to identifying people with suicidal tendencies. The problem is whether or not you can get people to take that test. But I believe it's 2011, MacArthur Fellow, Matthew Nock of Harvard University, has been testing a five-minute computer test, which essentially may be able to identify whether people are suicidal or not based on unconscious associations they have. So that's a test that's already been shown to effectively identify racial bias, gender bias, age bias, other things that are unconscious. It may be able to, with some further testing, identify people who are suicidal ahead of time as well.
So you could get suicidal people, but not necessarily focus in on people who might be suicidal by policemen, as we have said earlier, or might put himself in a position where he was going to get shot because he was shooting.
Well, the research suggests that people who commit suicide by cop or people who commit suicide have those same underlying urges. It's just the difference between, not to be morbid, but the difference between hanging yourself or jumping in front of a train.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much. Obviously, we're going to hear a lot of debate about gun control as the days go by. The president is pushing hard for it. He's getting petitions from around the country. The NRA is responding, as we have heard, in the way that it traditionally does, even though it waited a week to do it. Got a lot of attention by virtue of doing that. Thank you again. Again, Tom Diaz, Making a Killing, The Business of Guns in America, the next book coming out, The Last Gun, How the Gun Industry is Killing Americans and What We Can Do to Stop It. Craig Whitney, a journalist, author of a new book, Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment. Brooks Barnes, media reporter for The New York Times. Adam Lankford, his book, The Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers and Rampage Shooters and Other Self-Destructive Killers. Thank you all very much for lending your authority to this program and to this conversation, which will be going on for a long, long time. Thanks to our guests. In a moment, the latest prospects, or lack of prospects, for avoiding the fiscal cliff. Back in a moment with To the Point from PR.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
We're only back with Popota's Notebook on To the Point. Here's House Speaker John Boehner explaining why he had to cancel his vote on what he called Plan B for avoiding the fiscal cliff.
And there was a perception created that, that vote last night was going to increase taxes. Now, I disagree with that characterization of the bill, but that impression was out there. And we had a number of our members who just really didn't want to be perceived as having raised taxes. That was the real issue.
Earlier today in the New York Times, Jackie Combs wrote that the Obama White House was as incredulous and bewildered about all of this as the rest of Washington. Jackie Combs, welcome to our program.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
Did that explanation by Mr. Boehner, do you think, clear up the incredulousness and bewilderment at the White House?
Well, not really, because it goes back to the question of why he ever went down this road with his Plan B to begin with. Given that ultimately he did not have the votes. I mean, he went into this whole episode post-election having with something to prove, which is that he could deliver Republican votes. And here he designed a piece of legislation tailor-made for his own Republican caucus with, frankly, no thought that it would pass the Senate or get signed by the president. And he couldn't even pass that. So I think people are still, there have been no new developments today that we're aware of. there's every chance that the president might fly to Hawaii tonight with his family for his vacation, you know, in hopes of coming back after Christmas and resuming some sort of negotiations, which I'm sure would continue while he's in Hawaii. But so we're still here cliffhanging.
Is the White House worried about perception? If, in fact, the president goes to Hawaii, will he lose this advantage he appears to have right now in public opinion that if the fiscal cliff occurs, the Republicans are going to get the blame for it?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. But, you know, the House has already left. The Senate is leaving today. It's hard to believe that many Americans not already inclined to do so would begrudge him Christmas holiday with his family in Hawaii, given the state of technology and communications today, and his ability on Air Force One to get back here as soon as he'd need to. But there's nobody here. There won't be anybody here. So, you know, these things get done by phone, even when everybody's in Washington. So you're right, the perception could be there, but it's going to hurt not just him, but every party in this. I mean, not even a week, you know, just a week ago today were the Newtown shootings. I wrote by Monday that people sort of had a new sense of optimism that the national grief over that would maybe had seemed to be softening the partisanship in the fiscal cliff talks. And there was some progress, but we've now seen that was just momentary.
There was the thought that, as we discussed on a program earlier this week, that Washington might produce some grown-ups as a result of what had happened in Connecticut. Well, what about Boehner now? There will be a different Congress coming into session after the 1st of January. Is he looking forward to the possibility, there won't be quite as many Republicans as there are now, that he might have a challenge to his speakership?
Well, you know, absolutely. It's complicated, though, because you can't have nominations from the floor of the House. He was overwhelmingly nominated by his party, House Republicans, after the election. And normally, when the majority party in the House, you know, has its vote to nominate the Speaker, that's tantamount to election because, you know, the majority controls. But now, here we're in this position where the official vote is January 3rd when, as you say, the new Congress is sworn in. And it'll be a new Congress that has a fewer Republicans than the current lame duck Congress because of their losses in November. And so he, you know, now, I mean, just to warn as an indication of just how quickly things have turned, it was only days ago that a leading Democrat in the House suggested that Speaker Boehner was trying to slow walk things so that he could get any deal would be cut after his January 3rd election as Speaker to preclude any trouble he might have getting reelected. And people, reporters, you know, duly, myself included, duly reported it, but nobody really took it all that seriously. Now we do. But what would happen is, you know, you'd have to have, you know, a little more than a dozen people either withhold their votes from him or vote for somebody else. But the result would be that would likely throw the election as Speaker to Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic minority leader, and it's hard to believe that Republicans would ever do something like that. But then it would have been hard to believe days ago that they would have ever done anything like they did yesterday.
Been getting harder and harder to believe a lot of the things we see going on in Washington. So there's this perception, said the speaker, that, with regard to tax increases, the president isn't going to back off some kind of tax increase, although he has come up from 250,000 people earning more than 250,000. What about the prospects of the fiscal cliff being resolved before the end of this year? Are they just down the tubes?
Well, it's looking increasingly unlikely, and I frankly didn't predict that. I thought there would be some, and most people I know thought there would be some resolution, and there still may be, but it's looking increasingly hard to imagine what it would be.
Mitch McConnell, the minority leader in the Senate, might he suddenly have a transformation of some kind, or is he satisfied to let things go as they are?
Exactly. Keep your eye on him. Nobody's been talking much about him in the past 6 weeks since the election. It's all been about the president and Speaker Boehner and Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader Democrat. But we learned in the summer of 2011 that if everything falls apart, the wily, as I call him, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell might come in with an idea that will, you know, he can get Speaker Boehner and the Republicans to get behind, and it'll get them out of the mess they're in. So I don't see, there's been no indication of what that might be yet, and I don't expect to see it today or even maybe before Christmas. But clearly, Mitch McConnell is likely to be a player in resolving this, however it gets resolved.
Of course, he himself will be up for re-election in Kentucky in 2014, and resentment might last that long if he does something that causes him to have a challenge.
Well, absolutely. He just needs to look around the Senate at his Republican colleagues and see people who are there by virtue of having bumped off his former Republican colleagues, including some friends of his, because they weren't deemed conservative enough by Tea Party-oriented people. His own Kentucky colleague, Rand Paul, is a senator who knocked off a Republican that Mitch McConnell supported. And now, that you, as you mentioned, Mitch McConnell faces re-election himself and has reason to fear a Tea Party challenge. He hired as his campaign manager the person who had been Rand Paul's campaign manager.
We're going to leave it at that. Jackie Combs, as always, White House correspondent for the New York Times. Many thanks. Good to have you with us.
Happy holidays.
Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Evan George, Anna Scott, Caitlin Schamberg, Technical Director Mike Newport, Managing Producer Sonia Geis. Thanks to the John Coltrane family. I'm Orman Olney. Join us again for To the Point from PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.